Welcome to the Background Briefing podcast. This week, the salvos, a matter of trust. One of the country's oldest charities is facing a crisis over claims of child sexual abuse. The Salvation Army has at least one known paedophile in its ranks, and allegations of at least one other. They're one of the biggest charities in the country, worth hundreds of millions of dollars. For more than a century, Australians have trusted the Salvation Army to take care of the homeless and the poor, the veterans and the addicts. But the organisation tasked with helping society's most vulnerable has also betrayed them.
He said, "Now we're all Christians here, aren't we?" "Yeah, of course we are." Then he said, "I have something to tell you. I have abused your daughter."
The Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sex Abuse hearings revealed that the Salvation Army has kept a known child sex offender, Major Colin Hagar, within its ranks to this day. In today's program, we'll hear how the Army has sheltered him, promoted him, and continued to allow him access to children until 8 months ago. A woman sexually abused as a child by Major Colin Hagar wasn't prepared to appear at the public commission hearings. But she tells her story publicly for the first time to Background Briefing.
So I was sexually abused when I was eight. I remember freezing. I remember just, they say it, like, it's just shock. You just go into shock, and just kind of melt down.
Background Briefing can also reveal there's another Salvation Army major accused in the 80s and 90s of sex offences who has continued as an officer. His case didn't come up at the Royal Commission hearings, but there are allegations he's sexually abused three people, including one who was a child. That victim is now a woman we'll call Bronte, who spoke for the first time to this program.
For people to disclose that they have abused children and for the Salvation Army to feel that their forgiveness is absolute and there's no requirement for that person to have that information disclosed to the police, that's not transparency. That's the thing I'd like to see stop.
But stopping it will be hard. Background Briefing understands just days ago the Salvation Army lost both its trained internal investigators, tasked with uncovering serious misconduct, one to stress leave and one permanently. This weekend is the Salvation Army's Red Shield appeal, but the revelations of child sexual abuse have proven too much for one Salvation Army chaplain, Cliff Randall.
As far as the Red Shield is concerned, I'm taking a backward step this year. I just don't feel that I could face up going door knocking. Unfortunately, I have lost a lot of faith in the leadership.
Charities depend on faith, the faith of their workers and the public, that they are doing the right thing. I'm Sarah Dingle, and this week on Background Briefing, a crisis of faith in one of Australia's oldest charities. In the grand ballroom of the five-star Westin Hotel, 700 of Sydney's well-to-do enjoy a three-course lunch. Captains of industry, like the multi-millionaire Roger Massey-Green, are here to launch the Salvation Army's 2014 Red Shield appeal.
What is the target for the Red Shield appeal this year?
Nationally, the target is just about $80 million, about the same as last year.
The shadow of the Royal Commission hovers over this launch. This year, the Royal Commission has heard terrible accounts of sexual, physical and emotional abuse at Salvation Army-run children's homes in the 60s and 70s. Donors like Roger Massey-Green are quick to make a distinction between the present and the past.
There are some people who are unhappy about what has happened, as we are deeply unhappy and we are ashamed and embarrassed, but people understand that the work of the Salvation Army goes on and they're supporting us more than ever before.
It's a sentiment echoed by Commissioner James Condon, head of the organisation in New South Wales, Queensland and the ACT.
As I sat through the first hearing, I felt shocked, ashamed and aggrieved at the abuse that happened in our children's homes at the hands of some officers of the Salvation Army and some employees. I want to assure you today that as the Commissioner of the Salvation Army, I have zero tolerance for child sexual abuse within the Salvation Army. I want to assure you that we have strong policies in place to protect children and all vulnerable people that come into our care.
But those policies are weak and appear to have been ignored by the organisation, including the Commissioner. The sun's dipping below the horizon in central western New South Wales, and kangaroos are gathering at the edge of the bush for a piece of bread.
Come on!
I'm at the rural property of a woman known to the Royal Commission as JH.
Here you are. Better hurry up before the birds get it.
She's now a grandmother, but in 1979, she and her husband were new arrivals in town. Eventually, JH had a much-desired baby girl, to the delight of her husband, Bill.
Oh, he was absolutely over the moon. And I would have had 50,000 kids just to have that one girl.
JH and her husband were active members of the Salvation Army. The Army ran a wide range of community services in town, a church, a women's group, and children's activities. When JH heard the Salvation Army needed a volunteer to run their op shop, she put up her hand.
And how many days a week did you work at the op shop?
5 days a week. On a Saturday, I would go in and I'd clean up. And then again, of course, on Sunday, it was church. So Salvation Army, 7 days a week, really.
And you taught Sunday school after?
Yes, I did.
In January 1989, Captain Colin Hagar and his wife Kerry arrived in town as the church's new Salvation Army officers. JH and her family, including her young daughter, met the Hagars straight away. JH's daughter has never told her story publicly before, but she's agreed to speak to Background Briefing. We'll call her J.I. Now in her 30s, J.I. says she remembers Colin and Kerry Hagar dropping by their house.
He was the one that sort of got in and had games with the kids and bonded with us, I would say. It's sort of, as they say, the grooming. He made me feel like I wanted to go back near him. Yeah, like he was giving me the attention that I needed.
That year, something was going very wrong. J.I. was sexually assaulted by Captain Colin Hagar. She was 8.
The occasions were like a kind of like climbing stairs. The first one was minor. The second one was even a little bit more severe. And then the third one was the worst. And that's why I remember the 3 different occasions of, because once they'd happened, I left the room straight away.
That room was Colin Hagar's office in the town's Salvation Army building known as the Citadel. J.I. didn't tell her parents, but they found out that same year.
Oh, I'll always remember that day. He was wearing short shorts, his top he always wore, and a hat. And then he said, before we start, I'd like to start in a prayer. And he prayed about forgiveness, not for forgiveness. He prayed about forgiveness, and then after that he said, now we're all Christians here, aren't we? Yeah, of course we are. Then he said, I have something to tell you. I have abused your daughter. And at that stage, I froze. I went cold all over. And he said, but don't worry about it. It wasn't serious. I just fingered her. And then he said, I'm glad that's all over now. And then he got up and he said, now I can go and save more souls. And he was gone.
Colin Hagar left behind him a devastated household. Their work and personal lives were heavily bound up in the Salvation Army. Now, JH and Bill had to extricate their family, care for their child, and hold Colin Hagar to account. Bill rang the army, and JH says a couple of days later, there was a meeting in the Citadel with 2 army officers.
One of them said, righto, do you mind if we tape this? And must have been Bill that said, no, that's fine. Okay, they put their hats down, they put the Bibles there. And then they started to interview us. And I can't remember what the interview said at all, except for the end of that interview. And one of them said, well, let's put it this way. Who do we believe? A man in uniform, Salvation Army man, of God, or else do we believe adherents of the church? You're just workers. That was when we both realised we had lost.
At the end of the meeting, the whole party went downstairs to the room where Sunday school was held. And then a Mrs. Milton entered, who had an intellectual disability. J.H. told Background Briefing what she told the Royal Commission.
And then all of a sudden, bless her soul, this lady came in. She was not quite with it. She came running in and she said, in front of everyone, I'm a good girl, I'm a good girl. You know, the captain was just trying to show me how to pray with our hands up my leg and him holding our breast, but I'm a good girl. And that is why Colin Hagar admitted the abuse. If that woman hadn't have run in and said anything to us, then it would have been our word against a God-fearing man. But because this woman came running in, yelling that, it blew his cover.
Mrs. Milton is now deceased. No tape of an interview with JH and Bill has been found. JH says she and her husband were told by the Salvation Army officers that they could go to the police, but if they didn't, the Salvation Army would fix it. JH took this to mean they would report it to police and there would be disciplinary action within the Salvation Army.
Of course. What do you think? This is a wonderful organisation. They're going to take this man to the police. They're going to have him stripped of his rank. They're going to throw him out of uniform. He's going to go into jail. All these things. Nothing.
Captain Colin Hagar admitted to the Salvation Army that he had sexually abused J.I. once, not three times. The Army didn't go to police, but took discreet internal action. The Army dismissed both Colin and Kerry Hagar and told them to keep the child sexual abuse a secret. A February 1990 letter to the Hagars from the organisation's chief secretary expressed sincere regret, but it indicated he had no choice.
The field secretary has conveyed the seriousness of your situation, which cannot be allowed within the ranks of officership, much less by the laws of the land.
Despite this feared breach of the law, the organisation didn't report Colin Hagar to police. In late February 1990, the Hagars sent a farewell letter to the community, in which they said,
"We're taking a break from the duties of officership so that we can spend more time on our own spiritual growth and thus hopefully be of more use to him when we resume our active service."
Meanwhile, Colin Hagar's victims had begun to break down. After that interview at the Citadel, no one from the Salvation Army contacted J.H. or her husband.
They didn't send us a letter. They didn't even ring us and say, how are you going? How is your daughter going? This is what's happening with the officers and that. And it truly was, it was like nothing. And then I started to slowly lose it. And that was when I went into this, it was a zombie state. You see, Colin Hagar took everything that I held dear to me.
Incredibly, J.H. kept working at the Salvation Army op shop, purely to maintain a routine.
Bill used to actually force me out of bed, get me in the car, take me to the Salvation Army. Now, I hated the place, but that was my salvation because I could get behind the counter into a little tea room and pop Valium and just wish the day away. I went on like a normal shell, I'd have to call it. I couldn't do anything. I was not there. I was someplace inside and I couldn't get out. I knew I was there, but I couldn't get out because I knew what he had done to my daughter.
Sexually abused and now effectively without her mother, 8-year-old J.I. was also falling apart.
Mum was very distant. I remember her sleeping a lot, and I remember her not being very well, and Dad used to just pick up the pieces. He just You know, he'd get us all up for school, we'd make our lunches, then we'd get home and Dad would be there and he'd make dinner and he'd wash the dishes, and there's some days I don't even remember Mum being there.
Background Briefing has seen photos of J.I. before and after the sexual abuse. In one school photo, there are a number of unusually large scabs on her face.
I did a lot of self-harm, a lot of scratching of my skin, which was sort of, that happened when I was stressed and things like that.
And I didn't know about her legs until she told me, but she picked holes in her leg, but you could see her face, absolutely. Not just pick, she dug, and that was her way of stressing.
At school, J.I. started to withdraw. A primary school report from 1991 shows her unwilling to speak in class and finding it hard to remember words.
What was school like for you?
I don't really remember. I don't remember struggling. I don't remember fighting anything. I think to me it was just, it's just a blur. I know high school I sort of was a lot of acting out, trying to get into trouble, yeah. But primary school I don't really remember.
J.I. didn't finish high school. The Salvation Army didn't offer J.H., J.I. or anyone else in the family support or counselling. But the army continued to look after the Hagars after their dismissal in 1990, finding them jobs and accommodation in Sydney. Just months after abusing a little girl, Colin Hagar, as a civilian, was made assistant manager of John Irwin Lodge, a Salvation Army hostel for homeless youth.
It was for young boys off the street, and the manager that was there at the time also had young children, him and his wife.
That's Major Cliff Randall, a chaplain of the Salvation Army. And you can read more about his story on our website. Cliff Randall says by giving Colin Hagar a job at John Irwin Lodge, the Salvation Army continued to provide Colin Hagar access to children.
The managers was not told anything about his background, so they weren't aware of any possibilities that could have happened to their own children.
They weren't aware of risk?
No. I believe they should have been made aware straight away. They had two boys and a girl. The girl was, I think, 11 at the time.
Background Briefing has contacted that former manager, who's still with the Salvation Army. He was not allowed to make any comment. Despite the Salvation Army's attempts to conceal Colin Hagar's sexual abuse of J.I., Cliff Randall says a few officers began to talk.
Somebody said, oh yeah, he'd abused a young girl in the corps and that's why he was stood down. So it was in about 92 that I really found out about it.
After dismissal, Colin Hagar was given counselling for 18 months. His counsellor was another Salvation Army officer called Peter Farthing. Just 2 months after dismissal, Colin Hagar told a Salvation Army interviewer that Peter Farthing's counselling had left him 100% improved and he was expecting to rejoin the Army. At the same time, Colin Hagar was also maintaining contact with his victims. He rang J.H.
I was coping with the Valium and all that, and all of a sudden the phone call started. He rang and he said, we're coming through the town and can we pop in and see how your daughter's going?
That's an extraordinary thing to say. What did you say?
I can't remember. I think I hung up. I can't honestly remember because I didn't want to hear his voice. I didn't want him near my daughter. That was all there was to it.
After one call in about 1991, Colin Hagar also sent a letter. In it, he wrote,
talking to you today made me realise just how much I mucked things up doing what I did. I'm now closer to the Lord than I ever was as an officer. We sent a feeler to the Army concerning readmission just a couple of months back, and whereas initially the Chief Secretary, Colonel Calvert, was saying never, this time they said maybe.
6 months after Colin Hagar's dismissal, documents in support of his readmission began to circulate amongst the leadership. In mid-1992, Colin Haggar's Salvation Army counsellor, Peter Farthing, sent a letter to the then head of the Salvation Army recommending readmission. It also suggested a 3-year period, during which time Colin Haggar would be specially mentored. Peter Farthing said he would be happy to be the special mentor, or Major James Condon, who knows Colin's case. Major James Condon had provided premarital counselling for the Haggars and attended their wedding. Today, James Condon is the head of the Salvation Army in the Eastern States, and we'll hear more about his relationship with Colin Haggar shortly. In January 1993, Captains Colin and Kerry Haggar were welcomed back into the fold, just 3 years after they'd been dismissed. Cliff Randall remembers that decision.
I was horrified to think that we allowed somebody to come back in who was a paedophile. Even when he was dismissed, he would be one of the first officers, him and his wife that I know of, who has been dismissed, given a quarters, a Salvation Army quarters, and a job straight away, with all of the help and the support and the counselling, when nothing was offered to the victims.
The victims of Colin Haggar's abuse found out he'd rejoined Salvation Army ranks from Colin Haggar himself. J.H. remembers.
One phone call said, yeah, we're back in the army and we are now in charge of the Sunshine Home for old people. I said, God, no. I mean, he's stabbing me all the time. Every phone call that came, it was like a stab. Guess what? I've still got control. Guess what? I've still got control. Not only of you, I've got control of the Salvation Army. I've got control of everyone.
At the same time, the Salvation Army was writing policies on child sexual abuse, but not following them. Background Briefing has discovered a document not tendered to the Royal Commission. It's from 1994 and sets out guidelines for all Australian Salvationists on reporting child abuse. It says, legislators believe that all citizens have a moral responsibility to report abuse, and legislation underlines this moral responsibility. It also says every effort should be made to support the alleged abuser and the child. Not only did the Salvation Army fail to follow its own policy in 1994, the organisation didn't officially report Colin Haggar's crime to authorities for the next 20 years. But claims of an unofficial report have surfaced. This year, Australia's most senior Salvation Army officer, James Condon, claimed to the Royal Commission that in early 1990 he went with Colin Haggar in a personal capacity to confess to police.
I really just went as a support person to be with him, as I referred earlier in the mentor-pastor relationship that I had with him.
It appears to have been an extremely unusual meeting with police. The Salvation Army Commissioner told counsel assisting the Royal Commission, Simeon Beckett, that the entire confession of child sexual abuse took place at the counter, where Colin Haggar spoke to the duty constable.
He told them that he had inappropriately touched a young girl. I remember him saying 8 years of age. I remember, as I stated earlier, when he said inappropriately touched, he referred to touching her on the vagina.
Did you tell the police officer the name of the child?
No, I don't recall him telling them. He wasn't asked for any specific details.
Did he tell them the name of the family?
No, I don't recall him telling them the name of the family.
Did he tell them the location where the offence took place?
No, I can't say for sure that he did.
What was the response of the police officer?
The police officer, as I recall it, in general terms, said there's nothing we can do about that unless the girl or her family report it to us.
Commissioner, you'd understand that on what you just said, that Mr. Haggar was effectively admitting, or was in fact admitting, that he had engaged in a criminal offence.
Absolutely. That's why we were there.
And that would have been sufficient of its own to take further action by the police.
One would have thought so, yes.
In a written statement to the Royal Commission, A detective inspector from the New South Wales Child Abuse Squad described police procedure at the time James Condon says Colin Hagar confessed to police. He said, as per state police regulations in 1990, any such confession would have immediately been referred to detectives, who would have separated the two Salvation Army officers and interviewed them both. No police records of Colin Hagar's alleged confession have been found. Commissioner Condon said although he was wearing his Salvation Army uniform to accompany Colin Hagar, he didn't make any notes of the police visit. Nor did he report to the Salvation Army to say he'd gone with Colin Hagar to confess his crime to police. The Royal Commission heard the first written record of this joint visit was in February 2014. In an email to an internal investigator, Colin Hagar's former counsellor, Major Peter Farthing, wrote, "James Condon told me that he went to the police with Colin, so it did happen." In March 2014, Commissioner James Condon initially made a statement to the Royal Commission that the police station was in Sydney's eastern suburbs. But in April, on the day he appeared at the hearings, he said it was in Parramatta, in Sydney's west.
And the reason we went to that police station, as I recall it at that time, was it was the, I'll use this term, but headquarters in terms of sex crimes squad.
Yes. Has it been suggested to you that the sex crime squad was located in Parramatta back in 1990?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And is that what then triggered your memory about?
Yes.
The next day, James Condon was cross-examined by John Agius QC, acting for the police.
Do you know that there was no child sex crime squad in the Parramatta police station in 1990?
No, I didn't know that.
Salvation Army Chaplain Major Cliff Randall was listening to James Condon's evidence. Commissioner James Condon told the Royal Commission that he took Colin Hagar to a police station in 1990. Do you think that happened?
That puts me in an awkward position. You've got to listen to what was said at the commission and wonder whether it really did happen or not. You'd hope that the commission is telling the truth, but I'm not sure.
James Condon told the Royal Commission that for 25 years, he accepted Colin Hagar's assertion that JH and her family forgave Colin Hagar. James Condon said he believed the victim's parents forgave Colin Hagar straight after he told them he'd sexually abused their 8-year-old daughter.
They forgave him?
Yes.
And they asked him to stay for dinner?
Yes.
And they asked him back for dinner?
Yes.
A number of times?
Yes.
Colin Hagar didn't give evidence at the Royal Commission, but his wife Kerry did. She also claimed that after admitting to sexually abusing J.I., she and Colin Hagar were invited to dinner with J.H., Bill and their children, including the victim.
Was there any discussion specifically of what your husband was said to have done to J.I.?
I spoke with J.H. and apologised to her.
At that stage, what did you understand had occurred?
That my husband had inappropriately touched J.I.
On how many occasions?
One.
And what was J.H.'s attitude?
She was very forgiving. She told me not to worry about it.
Both the victim, J.I., and her mother, J.H., dispute there was any such dinner. Kerry Hagar and James Condon gave evidence to the Royal Commission after J.H., who was unable to publicly respond to their claims.
In fact, I sent an email to the Royal Commission. I mean, how could you do that? No mother would do that to their child. They wouldn't put it through. And even if I was down in the depths of hell, I would have probably put a knife to him.
In 2002, the Salvation Army supported Colin Hagar in obtaining a Working with Children check. 5 years later, Colin Hagar's former counsellor, Peter Farthing, wrote the organisation's Sex Offender Minute. It's a policy saying no one convicted or cautioned for a sexual offence can be readmitted to officership. But Peter Farthing told the Royal Commission he didn't mean for that policy to act retrospectively.
So when I wrote, will be reaccepted, I meant from that date on, someone who reapplied will not be reaccepted.
So what it meant was from September 2007, don't bother applying.
Yes, that's right.
In 2012, still with his Working with Children check, Colin Hagar was appointed manager of Samaritan Services and Foster House, a shelter for homeless men and adolescent boys. After his appointment, Samaritan Services took over a Salvation Army women's and children's shelter. Colin Hagar became assistant director of the combined service. Once again, Salvation Army chaplain Cliff Randall was horrified.
It would be like putting a drunk in charge of a bar, really. You're putting temptation in front of him.
Background Briefing understands that the Salvation Army chaplain at Foster House, under Colin Hagar, had no idea of Colin Hagar's past. The chaplain declined an interview, saying there were parts of the Salvation Army he wasn't happy about, but that's life. Last year, Colin Hagar appeared on Channel 7's Sunrise, presenting Salvation Army research on the number of children living in poverty and spruiking the Red Shield appeal.
So for more on this, I'm joined now by Lieutenant Colonel Colin Hagar from the Salvos. Good morning to you.
Morning, ma'am.
The number of kids living in poverty, has that number surprised you?
Look, it does. I mean, a lot of the figures out of the report, sadly, don't surprise me. Anecdotally, over the years...
J.H. was watching Sunrise at home.
I would have expected to come out.
I actually saw him on TV on the Sunrise, and I looked, and that was it. I said, "No, this is no good. Why the hell don't they wake up to themselves? Why can't they realise that they've got an abuser in there?"
Apart from Colin Hagar's sexual abuse of J.I., Background Briefing can reveal at least five other allegations of sexual abuse against Colin Hagar have been made to the Salvation Army over the years. A May 1990 Salvation Army file note, marked strictly confidential, records an alleged phone call from J.H. to the Salvation Army, where J.H. cited other cases of his advances to other women, which confirmed his sexual problems. Background Briefing has learned that in 2008, a further allegation against Colin Hagar was made to the Salvation Army, which was not revealed at the Royal Commission hearings. An officer sent a memo to her superior saying that while she was collecting money for the Salvation Army at a pub, she was approached by a woman. The woman asked if Colin Hagar was still in the army and said while Colin Hagar was in JH's town in the late 80s, he'd molested her daughter and given her a disease. J.H. says that woman was not her. In April 2013, Commissioner James Condon ordered officers to report all allegations of child sexual abuse to headquarters so that the Salvation Army could prepare for the Royal Commission. Salvation Army officer Donna Evans emailed saying she was working in a town close to J.H.'s in 1989. She said while there, she was told on one occasion Colin Hagar had been minding children, and when a parent returned, they found semen in a girl's underwear. James Condon told the Royal Commission he considered that hearsay and did not investigate it. But he did interview Colin Hagar in 2013 about the allegation that Colin Hagar had touched the intellectually disabled Mrs. Milton, which had surfaced again.
And what was his response?
He denied it, yes.
And what did you do then?
I don't recall that we did anything further following that.
Once again, Commissioner James Condon said he didn't make any notes of that interview. Colin Hagar remained in his position as Assistant Director for Samaritan Services until September 2013, when a young Salvation Army officer blew the whistle. Captain Michelle White had become aware of Colin Hagar's name and child sexual offence in May. After a series of meetings and emails with Commissioner James Condon about the need to report Colin Hagar to authorities, Michelle White became concerned that Colin Hagar had been left in his position. In August 2013, Colin Hagar applied to renew his Working with Children check. In September, Michelle White had had enough and went outside her organisation to report Colin Hagar to the Office of the Children's Guardian, the Royal Commission and the New South Wales Ombudsman. It was the first time on record that anyone from the Salvation Army had reported Colin Hagar for sexually abusing an 8-year-old girl in 1989, even though he'd admitted it at the time. That victim, J.I., realised what Captain White had done at the Royal Commission.
I just wanted to thank her for not letting it go, because she could have just let it go and she could have just, it could have disappeared again through paperwork or whatever. But she didn't let it go. And, you know, she stood up for people like me. She put her uniform at risk for someone she didn't even know.
Background Briefing contacted Captain Michelle White for an interview, but we were told she was not permitted by the Salvation Army to speak to this program. Background Briefing can reveal that Colin Hagar is not the only Salvation Army major who allegedly abused children and women in the community and was not reported to authorities by the organisation. Multiple allegations of sexual abuse have been made against a second major, now in his 80s, which were not examined by the Royal Commission hearings. We'll call him Major A. Background Briefing understands in the last fortnight, three women have made statements to police about Major A. Two were young women at the time of the alleged sexual abuse in the early 1980s, and one has an intellectual disability. The third alleged victim is now a 49-year-old professional we'll call Bronte. Bronte alleges from the age of four, Major A began to sexually abuse her.
We're talking initially the abuse started as him inserting his fingers into my genitals.
She says the sexual abuse continued until she was 11, when Major A allegedly attempted full intercourse with her in his Sydney office.
With every ounce of courage that I had at 11 and a half, I kicked out and pushed and shoved and screamed and yelled as much as I possibly could, and he backed away.
After years of secrecy, Bronte says she reported her child sexual abuse to the Salvation Army in 1995, almost 20 years ago.
I sent that information to Territorial Headquarters in Sydney, to the attention of the then Chief Secretary of the Salvation Army, and received no response whatsoever.
Last December, a friend encouraged Bronte to again make a statement to the Salvation Army about her alleged sexual abuse as a child. She did so in January.
I have no official correspondence from the Salvation Army acknowledging that I have made these claims, assuring me that they'll be fully investigated. Nothing whatsoever. To me, that's not transparency. That's not a genuine concern. And it makes me feel very nervous about where the Salvation Army's position in regard to all of these claims actually is. My gut feeling is that the Salvation Army would prefer for it to just go away.
Background Briefing has found evidence of Bronte's alleged perpetrator playing an active role in the Salvation Army until as recently as 2013. Bronte says she finds his continued work for the organisation appalling.
I feel disgust and disappointment that he wears a uniform that he's not worthy to wear. I feel disappointment in the leadership, that the priority has been to extend grace to this man and not justice to the victims.
Bronte has now made a full statement to police about Major A. Background Briefing can reveal that days ago the Army was left without either of its trained internal investigators. Background Briefing understands one is on stress leave and the other has had his contract discontinued before finishing the investigation into the Army's handling of Colin Hagar. Last month, James Condon had his position as head of the Salvation Army in the Eastern States renewed by his superior in London. J.I. believes that James Condon, for so many years Colin Hagar's mentor and pastor, should step down.
I don't think he should have his job.
Will you go to the police about what Colin Hagar did to you?
Yeah. My counsellor's helped me a lot, and I feel like I'm ready to do it.
Background Briefing requested interviews with Colin Haggar and Salvation Army leadership, including Commissioner James Condon, but no one was prepared to speak with us. We asked the Salvation Army a series of questions, all of which they declined to answer. You can read our questions and their response on our website. Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research by Anna Whitfeld. Technical production by Phil McKellar. The executive producer is Chris Bullock, and I'm Sarah Dingle.